You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
Last week, the Board of State Canvassers approved a petition that might end prohibition of marijuana in Michigan, recreational marijuana. And this week marks the 100th anniversary of another important social experiment, prohibition. It was this week in 1918 when Michigan said no to alcohol. Just what led Michigan and eventually the entire nation to think banning alcohol was a pretty fine idea? Let's talk prohibition now with the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark, along with writer, historian, and curator of the blog Prohibition Detroit, Mickey Lyons. Great to welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Rachel, in the decade or so leading up to prohibition, what was a typical Michigander's interaction with alcohol?
Sort of depended on where you live, but Michigan has had breweries and distilleries since basically we became a state, beginning with German immigrants brewing the beers they would have found back home. So for the most part, it wasn't hard to find. But by the 1890s, the Anti-Saloon League, that is founded, quickly becomes a national organization. And some counties start to look at prohibition as a possible movement within their county.
Mickey, why was the ground so fertile for this anti-saloon movement to just take off?
So there's quite a few different reasons. One of them, by the time you get to, say, the industrialization of the state, and especially in Detroit, you've got this xenophobic fear of immigrants and their culture. And you've also got World War I, and we don't like the Germans, and the Germans are the ones that are making beer. You can also tie in, I would say, temperance with women's suffrage. The temperance movement in Michigan and national was very much tied into the women's suffrage movement.
And I think a lot of people are surprised to realize that those two intersected. How so?
They really went hand in hand because, sort of as one of the great social ills, alcohol was very much tied and has been since we first started making alcohol, has been tied to domestic violence. So that was one of the major reasons. And most of the campaigns for prohibition throughout the state of Michigan and elsewhere were headed by the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was a bunch of women who said, not only we've got to get rid of the booze, this is a social evil, this is a terrible thing for families and for all of society, but also we need to get the vote in order to get rid of the saloons. So actually, women's suffrage in Michigan happened in 1918, just a little bit after we passed the prohibition laws.
Interesting. And so the movement's growing leading up to 1918. Who were the interested stakeholders? Did the business community throw its support on either side?
Mostly, yes. And most of them were on the side of temperance. Henry Ford was famous for absolutely hating people who drank in Michigan and in his factories. S.S. Kresge, too, was notoriously dry. He donated $500,000 to the Michigan Temperance Campaign. And he testified in front of Congress when Congress was debating nationally whether to go with prohibition. He testified and said that at Henry Ford's factory in Highland Park, for example, truancy rates among employees had dropped down by almost half.
It is worth noting the fame anti-booze crusader Carrie Nation certainly made her mark in Southeast Michigan with her equally famous hatchet.
Yes, she visited the state in 1908 and spent some time in Detroit, but also went through the rest of the state, too. She went up to Holly, Michigan, and was at the Holly Hotel, at least, at the same time that the then governor was doing a rally outside, and she came outside and stood in front of him and just harangued him. It was fantastic.
And used her hatchet on the bar there at the Holly Hotel.
So they say,
so
yeah.
So they say. Rachel, was there anyone in Michigan looking for compromise, like, let's let the towns decide on their own whether or not to ban alcohol?
Well, you're getting politicians in the different counties who are unsure of how to move forward because, you know, alcohol industry at that time equated jobs in a lot of cases. And so they come in 1910 with dry options where counties and towns, mostly counties, can decide for themselves whether they're going to be wet or dry. So in 1910, 36 counties go dry, but it was a sort of a weird process because they're two-year options. So in 1910, you can get counties that choose dry, and in 1912, they turn around and they're wet again. And then in 14, they get to vote again. And so there are counties like Eaton County that sort of flip-flop back and forth between dry and wet every 2 years. And so the brewers and distributors just sort of wait. But the rest of the counties in the state remain wet. And a lot of those, as Mickey said, those are going to be counties with high immigrant populations, counties with alcohol is sort of part of their culture that goes along with it. And so there are definite patterns in the counties that vote dry versus the ones that remain wet.
Mickey, walk us through the process. How did prohibition become the law here?
So we've had many attempts before Michigan became a state. For a lot of its history, the state has been trying to regulate how much Detroiters in particular drink. So you see the same dichotomy between the rural, conservative rest of the state and the liberal, hard-drinking, shall we say, Detroit. So this one was a statewide general vote to amend the state's constitution. And the vote happened in November of 1916 to go into effect later. It was one of the highest voter turnouts in the entire history of the state.
So people were really exercised about this.
Yeah. And the option was between, like Rachel said, home rule, where each county, even down to the cities, could decide whether to stay wet or go dry, or a statewide prohibition amendment. And it surprisingly won fairly handily. I think thanks a lot to the women campaigning. 900 women showed up at the poll booths to volunteer to sort of pressure folks into voting the right way.
So on this week in 1918, exactly what happened?
Well, everyone was a little bit surprised by how much of a dud it was.
Is this the week, no more sales
absolutely.
As of this week?
May 1st.
All right.
So May 1st it happened. So at midnight on the last day of April into May 1st. And everyone had known it was coming to the extent that a lot of the brewers and the liquor distributors had sort of just said, you take what you can get. That's all we have left. So many of the saloons and bars in Detroit tried to have funerals for John Barleycorn and King Alcohol, but they ran out of alcohol. So most of the saloons in Detroit by 10 o'clock on the Saturday night before Prohibition went into effect were already closed. So everyone just took the parties home, really.
Yeah. In fact, your story in our Detroit magazine has a funny picture of people lining up outside a liquor store. The last call.
The last
buy
call.
Now.
Yes. Buy now. You'll never get it again. And then, you know, within a day of Prohibition going into effect, we had arrests for bootlegging.
Oh, so. I love it. So let's talk about that a little bit. So here we get May 1st, no more alcohol sales. Give us an idea of the lengths people went to in order to get booze. And I got to have you talk about Dixie Highway. Yeah, tell us.
Yes. So Dixie Highway had conveniently just been paved between Detroit and Monroe and then Monroe and Toledo. Ohio was still wet, so it's a little more than an hour's drive at this point from Detroit down there. People are clogging up trains, just hanging off the sides of trains. There is a nonstop traffic jam on Dixie Highway between Detroit, Monroe, and Toledo. And Monroe police just don't know what to do. They just cannot handle this influx. So they called it the Avenue du Booze because it was so popular. And this is what we did for, you know, the 2 years until National Prohibition.
Oh, my word. That's great. Yeah. Rachel, Mickey's an expert, particularly on Detroit Prohibition. Did you find anything in your research on what the reaction was in West Michigan?
Well, for 2 years, it sounds very similar to Detroit area. So for 2 years, between 1918 when Michigan went dry and 1920 when the nation went dry, Chicago was still wet. And so alcohol was making its way up the west coast of Michigan. And then after the Volstead Act, you get people, especially in Muskegon County, I found, who start brewing their own small batches of homebrew. And Muskegon at that time was still very rural, and it also had clean, cold rivers to feed these stills. And so they just continued on these small batches of brew and distributed locally and then started increasing that distribution. But one of the things that I read that was actually very smart of them is that they never really got into the Chicago mob distribution system. They stayed sort of on their own without getting into the Al Capone sort of market. So that actually allowed them to make a lot of money. and sort of kept under the radar compared to other places like Chicago and Detroit during Prohibition.
Fascinating history. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and writer, historian, and curator of the blog Prohibition Detroit, Mickey Lyons. And there is a fascinating story Mickey's written, Dry Times, and you'll find it in our Detroit magazine. Thanks to both of you for this fascinating backstory on Prohibition in Michigan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. It was great being here.